This podcast includes information provided by the issuer and does not express the views of the interviewer. This podcast may also include forward-looking statements by the issuer that involve certain risks and uncertainties to its business. Because forward-looking statements are subject to risks and uncertainties, the issuer's actual results could differ from those indicated in this podcast. Welcome to the Planet Microcap Podcast. I'm your host, Robert Kraft, and thank you all so much for the support and for tuning in to the Planet Microcap Podcast. You can follow the podcast on Twitter at Bobby K. Kraft. That's BobbyKKraft. And you are listening to episode 24. For this episode of the Planet Microcap Podcast, I spoke with Sam Namiri, associate at Grand Slam Asset Management. I've met Sam at many microcap conferences over the years, and we would exchange ideas about what is going on in the microcap market. I thought it would be informative to do an interview with Sam and share with all of you what I've learned in my conversations with him. In this interview, we discuss Sam's microcap investing strategy and how that's evolved since he started at lunchtime in high school. Specifically, what I thought was very interesting for this interview and the goal for this episode is to understand how to value a microcap stock according to Sam. Thank you again for tuning in to episode 24 of the Planet Microcap Podcast. Please enjoy my interview with Sam Namiri, but first, a word from our sponsor.
A comprehensive streaming of market data, research, and portfolio management application for you. QuoteStream is a real-time streaming quotes and research system designed for the day trader, retail investor, institutional investor, both new and old. QuoteStream offers low latency, tick-by-tick data, advanced charting, comprehensive technical analysis, news, and research. With no software to install and no servers to maintain, QuoteStream is the ideal solution for you. Go to stocknewsnow.com and start your free 7-day trial. Click the QuoteStream banner in the header or real-time quotes in the nav bar to get started building and managing your investments.
For this episode of the Planet Microcap Podcast, I have Sam Namiri, associate at Grand Slam Asset Management on the program. Sam, welcome to the Planet Microcap Podcast.
Thanks for having me, Robert.
It's my pleasure. Thank you for coming on. So to start off, as we do in every episode, I want to know, what is your background and how did you get into microcap investing?
Okay, so I guess microcap investing even precedes my background, so I'll start off there. When I was in high school, me and another guest you've had on the show, Chris Lahiji, we went to high school together, and during our lunch breaks, we would, you know, go on the computer and dial up our internet and go on Yahoo Finance, and, you know, we were just always interested in different stocks, which at the time was, you know, late 90s tech bubble. And so we would always try to find, you know, the next tech company that would, you know, go up 50 times, 100 times, and that's how I got into microcap investing originally. And I guess after that, you know, I went to college at Berkeley, studied engineering. I had a jewelry company afterwards that I founded and ran. Eventually I went to business school and ended up now at a hedge fund called Grand Slam Asset Management.
And so, you know, how do you go about investing in microcap stocks? You know, what is your strategy? I mean, you know, you've been doing it a while now.
Yeah, my strategy has evolved quite a bit since, you know, back in my high school days. and what changed for me a lot was I would invest in stocks and they would come out and beat earnings numbers, for instance, what was projected. And the stock would, you know, for some reason go down even after beating earnings. And I realized that, you know, maybe I'm not understanding certain things in terms of valuing a stock. And so for me, when I went to business school, the main thing that I tried to learn and understand was valuation and how to come up with a good valuation. And I went to Columbia Business School, and they're known for their value investing program. And, you know, I took a lot of classes with a lot of professors who, you know, themselves are active hedge fund managers. And that was one of my focuses, was not only just valuation, but also, you know, trying to understand what makes a business good and what makes a strong business. And so when I look at a microcap company, there's three general questions that I ask myself. The first question is, do I like the business? Do I think it's a good business? that's obviously quite qualitative in terms of how you look at that usually. But one of the things I look at is I like to look for a company that has recurring revenues, and that's either contractual recurring or recurring in nature. So just to give an example, as a business that, you know, everybody knows that's recurring revenues is like Coca-Cola. Coca-Cola, once you drink it, it's gone. You know, you have to go and buy another one to drink some more. And so, you know, people always get thirsty. They're not going to stop getting thirsty. And, you know, whether they choose Coke or not, that's a different question. But, you know, usually if you're going to drink soda, you're going to drink either Coke or Pepsi. And, I mean, to me, Coke is a great business still. I know it's not growing. But, again, like when I look at a quality of a business, I like to find something that has that recurring nature in it. The second question I always ask is do I like the people running it, and do they have skin in the game? And so that for me, I always try to find someone. I used to have a jewelry business myself and ran that, and, you know, I know what it's like from the inside operating a business. And so when I look at another business, I like to make sure that the people running it are running it, you know, the way I think it should be run to some degree, and, you know, that they're running it really well and they have the systems and tools in place to continue running it well. And then the third question I always look for is this valuation. I want to make sure that I'm buying the company's shares at a cheap enough price that I think logically and realistically will move up in value based off of some quantitative valuation method.
So I think that's one of the main themes for this episode of the podcast is valuation, and how do you come to that whatever it is, that number or that one metric, so that you can make that decision. So I guess this kind of leads into my next question. You know, how then in your opinion, what is a quality microcap company?
So a quality microcap company to me is. There's a few factors that really matter to me. I mentioned recurring revenue, so I won't really talk more about that. The one thing I also like to look for is the stickiness in the business. How much would it cost someone to switch to a competitor in that business? To me, that's an important way to measure, you know, whether, you know, a microcap company is quality or not. You know, I don't like to invest in commodity businesses that, you know, it's very easy to switch between, you know, one business versus another business's products, because then essentially everyone is pricing to the dumbest competitor in the room. And, you know, if you have 100 competitors, you're bound to find one that's going to, you know, charge, you know, below their actual cost of pricing. So the example I like to give is, you know, if I used to sell jewelry. And I can sell you gold, and you would probably buy gold all day long if I priced it below what the market value of gold was, you know. And so when I look at quality, I try to find businesses that, you know, have pricing power, and that's usually because there's not much competition, or if there is, there's stickiness to the product. So again, like Coke and Pepsi, as an example again, you know, Coke can charge more for their product because you know what you're getting when you're buying a can of Coke. It's going to taste the same pretty much forever. You know, Pepsi the same way. They've built that brand equity into the business. You're not going to go get the generic brand cola from, you know, your local grocery store instead because, you know, it's not worth that extra, you know, 50 cents you're going to save per can or whatever it is, you know, to potentially miss out on that taste that you came to expect from Coke. So that's something I look for in the business. So again, that's stickiness and lack of competition. And then I also, again, management is very important. And it's not just management in terms of whether, you know, I think they're smart or whether they own a lot of shares and have skin in the game, but, you know, what have they done culturally in the company? You know, do employees that work for them, do they like working for them? One of the things that I do for every investment that we make is I visit every company. I try to go to trade shows of all the companies that, you know, we potentially will make investments in. I like to talk to the competitors, suppliers, customers, you know, to make sure that, you know, what I think about the business actually holds true. Like, is there stickiness in their product? You know, does the business offer a good value to the customer? And so those are like the main things that I look for when I look for a quality of a customer, of a business.
So then, when after you put all of that stuff together, I mean, now we're talking about timing. So then, how do you know when, for any of the companies that you're looking at, how do you know them when to buy, sell, or hold?
For me, that's probably the hardest question I think that anyone can ever answer. And I mean, for someone to tell you that they know how to time buying and selling stocks or anything similar to that matter in a fluid market, I think is either lying to themselves or lying to you. But I mean, there's obviously certain strategies that I like to look for. I like to buy stocks that are trading at low multiples, and it's usually low multiples of cash flow. I sometimes trade on revenue multiples, but I don't like to look at revenue multiples because I just don't trust them. I gave that example about buying and selling gold. You know, I could grow a business's revenue by selling gold, you know, below market price all day long, but I'm losing money for that. So I don't like to look at revenue multiples generally. And so to buy, I like to buy when a business has had a hiccup, because I think that people panic, and you know, emotionally, people sell things irrationally much more than they buy irrationally. When a stock goes down, people start panicking, and they kind of, you know, ride that snowball down the hill and continue, you know, exacerbating that panic and driving the stock down. I mean, it's very, very hard to catch a falling knife, but usually I like to look at businesses, and the best investments that I've made have been when companies may have made an acquisition that didn't pan out, or they miss their earnings estimates for some reason that, you know, it's more, I try to figure out whether it's one time in nature or whether it's actually a problem in the business or not. Mm-hmm. And so timing wise, again, if you pay a low multiple for a stock, it kind of to some degree protects you on the downside, because I mean, if you look at cash flow of a business, how much can that actually really drop in terms of the multiple you get for it? Mm-hmm. And so if I'm buying something at a 5x EBITDA multiple, I mean, it can't really go too much lower than that. Versus if I'm buying something at a 20x EBITDA multiple, you know, it can very easily go down to a, you know, 8 to 10x multiple very, very quickly if the market sees an issue with the company. Mm-hmm. And so that I like to look at that when I try to buy. And also I like to find a company that can potentially at least double within 2 years. And so I don't buy a company unless I think the stock can double at least within 2 years. Mm-hmm. So that's on the buy side. Holding, and with microcaps, another point I like to make is with microcaps, since a lot of them are very liquid, you can't buy a full position all at one time.
Right.
You kind of got to work your way into it. And I have check marks that I try to hit, or check posts that I try to hit as to when, what I need to do to build up a position. And so I'll build up to a certain size position, and then I'll speak with management on the phone, and then I'll build up even more after that. You know, I'll go to trade shows and make company visits and do, as I get more and more comfortable with the research that I've done on a position, that's when I build during that time, and I build it out during that time. And so that, I mean, it can take some time. It can take like 6 months to a year for, you know, on the long side in terms of building a position and buying shares of a company. Mm-hmm. And, you know, and so that's on the actual execution side of it. And then usually I hold the shares for, you know, ideally for less than 2 years until it doubles. And I build a financial model out where, you know, it makes sense to me valuation-wise what can happen in a year or two. And based off that, I look at competitors in the industry or, you know, a similar business and see what that trades at in terms of the EBITDA multiple. And I look 2 years out, and once I get to a similar valuation as those competitors, that's when I look to sell. Mm-hmm. And so if I sell a stock and it keeps running up afterwards, I'm okay with that because, in my opinion, it's already hit the value that I think the company is worth on a logical basis. And so sometimes you'll find companies that, you know, they do really well and they'll double, and you know what, they may double again after that. But again, like I try to keep my sell discipline and sell when I think it's actually hit what I truly believe is the value of the company on a reasonable basis.
You know, that's interesting because on the podcast, I would say most of our guests usually sell when something like fundamental about the company does change, you know, whether it's like the messaging, the management, or the business model. So it's interesting that you come at it from a different approach. You don't care. Like even if it continues to go up, in your opinion, you have that strict discipline where you in your head, okay, it hit this level. And even if it goes up, I have a realistic expectation that it's probably going to go back down, if not lower than the price that I sold it at. So I guess this is kind of a funny way to follow up to that. Has that ever really bit you in the butt?
Trying to think. I try not to think about that because next time it happens, I'm in that situation. I'll be like, maybe I should hold on a little longer. That example that I gave you was when things work out well.
Sure.
I do sell again when something does fundamentally change, okay. And it's usually more, you know, did a competitor come into the industry? Did the industry dynamic in some way change? Or did I learn something new about the industry or the company that, you know, I end up not liking and it really raises a red flag? So, I mean, at that point, depending on how big of a red flag it is, you try to sell, you know, immediately all the shares you can. Mm-hmm. But, I mean, in terms of that hitting me in the butt, we had an investment in Taser a long time ago, and I think after we sold there, I can't even tell you how many times I probably went up 30x afterwards. but again, that company ran way ahead of itself in terms of valuation.
Yeah.
And so I think it dropped down quite a bit after it ran up 30x, and you know, when it comes to buying and selling, I know I can never call the bottom, and I know I can never call the top. Mm. And I think the key is just to be realistic in understanding that, and you know, so at times taking advantage of it. Because if you have conviction in a company and you think it's really good, I actually, especially when I'm building my position, I actually like the fact that it's getting cheaper, and if it goes down and it gets less expensive in price, because not only am I decreasing the amount of risk in the company, because if I'm buying a company at a cheaper price, that's essentially less that I could potentially lose. But again, I'm probably getting more than a double that once it gets cheaper, because you know the price has gotten cheaper. So now my upside is much higher, in my opinion. So,
what I want to know, just to follow up on that real quick, is you know how do you know a company has gotten way ahead of itself in terms of valuation? You know, like you had your estimate where it's going to hit this and, you know, but then as you said with that one company, it went up 30x. Like how does that happen and what does that mean?
So I like to look at cash flows again. And so when it runs ahead of itself, it's basing off of the current business performance,
mm-hmm.
you know, what they have to do to actually, you know, get a decent multiple on the stock for their cash flow, a decent cash flow multiple versus what the stock is valued at. Mm-hmm. So if a company is valued at, let's say, $200 million, and they're doing like $5 million a year in EBITDA, mm-hmm. like I don't want to pay that much for the company. I don't want to pay 40 times for the company.
Mm-hmm.
And so... yeah, to me, like it has to grow a good amount to get to that valuation, like a logical valuation. So, I mean, again, the EBITDA to me doesn't make any sense. The valuation compared to the cash flow doesn't make any sense, unless like you know they've publicly announced that they have you know the deals in place or contracts in place to be able to you know increase their EBITDA quite substantially. I mean, I don't want to have to pay I don't want to have to pay for that risk of that growth for the valuation. And so for me, again, when I see something that's, you know, it's already doubled and I don't see that amount of growth and there's way too many risks between, you know, the current cash flow versus what, you know, potential future cash flow needs to be to support that valuation, that's what I consider it running ahead of itself.
Okay.
So maybe to say that a little bit more clearly is if a company is doing $5 million in EBITDA today, and, you know, they're projecting out in 2 years that it's going to be doing $50 million in EBITDA, if I don't see the connection very clearly between 5 and 50, and the enterprise value of the stock is trading on a multiple of that, that doesn't make sense. Of the $5 million, it doesn't make sense. I'm happy getting out of it because I'm not willing to pay for the risk of that growth actually happening or not.
So, actually, I did have another question regarding how do you assess a quality business model, but I feel like you kind of went over that a little bit earlier, and I kind of want to get to my next question because that actually I think really ties in to this idea of valuation, and it's something that we haven't really covered yet on the podcast, and it's a term, the term was that you create these financial models. So what I want to know is what is that exactly, and why is that important when you're doing your due diligence?
Okay, so a financial model is when you open up a company's K or Q, you know, they always start off with a balance sheet, income statement, statement of cash flows. And so when I create a financial model, I go back and, you know, take the history of all those financial statements and, you know, put that into Excel and try to project out at least 2 years, the next 2 years, into what I think those statements should or could look like. And so a lot of it is all those statements, they talk to each other, you know, accounting is its own language. And so a financial model is essentially my projections and a way to link all those statements together to look out 2-3 years. And the way I try to do that is a little bit differently is I try to break down each component into subcomponents. So revenues, I try to break down, for example, you know, what makes up revenues of a company? It's the quantity of how many items they sell times the price of each item. So, you know, on microcaps, it becomes a little easier to do because companies don't have a ton of different products. And so I try to break it down into those components. You know, the costs, whatever the company gives you, I try to break it down into, you know, understanding what the costs are, what costs go into the business. You know, is it employee headcount? You know, is there operational leverage in the business? And that helps me, again, if revenues can grow and you have a lot of operational leverage in the business, you know, you should have a better margin and your cost of goods should be less than what revenues grow as a ratio. And so that's the type of work that I do, at least on the income statement side of building a financial model.
And why do you think, when you're projecting it out, like, do you have an algorithm that, or not an algorithm, but like some kind of equation that you plug into your Excel that will then give you the realistic number that you think it will be at, you know, 1 or 2 years from the time that you're calculating all those numbers?
I wouldn't say it's an equation. It's very company specific. So you have to look at each line and see, you know, what do you think is going to happen, or how is that going to change over time? This is where it comes down to work of making sure you read all the press releases, you know, on all of the Q's and K's of the companies to make investments in. I look at, you know, the management discussion and analysis section where they give commentary as to, you know, why did revenues grow over last year, or why did revenue shrink over last year? And then companies that do the quarterly conference calls. You know, I go over those transcripts or I re-listen to them, you know, and take notes. And I use that information to, you know, update the models and try to figure out, you know, my projections, my own personal projections as to, you know, what I think the company can do. And so, I try to look at other drivers, like, you know, maybe it's a population, based on population growth, a business grows. Or, you know, maybe there's, like, you know, 10% demand historically for this business, and you know, I'll price that in going forward to see, you know, what happens to the financials of the business if I, you know, put in that driver to my model.
Mm-hmm. So I want to ask another question that actually is kind of based on what you said in your background is, you know, this idea of a value investor. Now, you know, I've read, you know, the Ben Graham books and One Up on Wall Street. I'm on my second time reading it. And, you know, I want to just kind of get a definition like as to what exactly that is. And, you know, why it also seems like it's kind of making a comeback of sorts. So, you know, like I want to know why this philosophy is kind of making this comeback.
Well, I think over long periods of time, the concept of value investing has outperformed growth investing. Mm-hmm. I mean, there's different ways that you can define what value is and what growth is. Mm-hmm. But if you look at, I think Fama French had a historical study. He had a historical study that was done, I forget, like 15, 20 years ago that they won the Nobel Prize for. And, I mean, he showed that over long periods of time, small and value outperform large and growth. Mm. And so, I mean, naturally, that somewhat does make sense because, I mean, once you're big, it's hard to get bigger. It's much easier to get big when you're small. You're nimble. You can adapt to changes much quicker. And when you're big, really, the only way you can get bigger is through acquisition. Mm. So inherently, there's natural, you know, catalysts as to performing as a small business versus a large business. And then in terms of growth versus value, I think, again, there's a saying like of hopes and dreams can last a very, very long time. And so I think emotionally, you know, people, when you pay for something, you think you get what you pay for in terms of, you know, an expensive item. When we go to luxury retailers and we buy, you know, I don't know, a Gucci wallet or something of that sort, you trust that, you know, you're paying a lot of money to get something that's of good quality. And, you know, a lot of times when you pay that money, the question is it worth what you paid or not? You know, if you try to go and resell that immediately right away, you know, you've probably lost a good amount of value there. And so as a value investor, when you're paying what you think is a cheap price, usually there's not much lower the price can go. And so inherently, I believe that reduces your risk on an investment when you pay on the surface, a cheap price. And so there's a professor at Columbia who wrote the magic formula. I think the Magic Book of Investing is what it's called, by Joel Greenblatt. Mm-hmm. And I mean, he only looks in with this formula at, you know, cheap PE stocks, cheap return on invested capital, or EV to EBITDA stocks. And, you know, a lot of these stocks, when you look at them, you know, the companies usually have big issues, or they're in an industry that has big issues. And so, you know, most people really hate on them, and, you know, the stock prices get incredibly cheap. But, you know, if one little thing doesn't turn out, I mean, if one thing turns out to be not as what people had expected, you know, the stock can easily double or triple after that. And so part of it is that, you know, no one likes to invest in businesses that, you know, aren't sexy, aren't cool, you know, aren't the next new thing that's going to, you know, be such a big sensation. And so when it comes to value, people overlook, you know, the steady, simple companies that, you know, someone like Warren Buffett likes to invest in. Mm-hmm. So I think people see, at the end of the day, it's all about performance, and it's all about, you know, how well you can do as an investor. And I think as people research investing, they realize that, you know, value investing is really the best way to go.
So in your investing career, and this is my favorite question, what experience did you learn from the most that to this day you will never forget and you always carry with you?
Well, I'll say in my career in general, the experience I learned the most from was running my own business. Mm. You know, from the inside, when you have to touch and feel every part of the business, from accounting to marketing to operations, like fulfillment, I mean, I don't think there's any better experience than to actually, you know, be be in the shoes of doing that. In my investing career, the experience I learned the most from was, let's think, you know, for me, it's company visits. I mean, and trade shows. I can't point to one experience that I've learned a lot from.
Well, like, here, let me phrase it differently. How about maybe, like, that one experience where you went to that trade show or you went to visit the company and you expected, and you kind of, or not even, you didn't have any expectations and you went in with, like, okay, you know, this is, I'm here to do my due diligence, and you saw something that you were like, holy moly, like, either on the good side or the bad side, you know, like, that made you realize, like, okay, for the next time I go on this visit or the next time I go to this trade show, I'm going to ask this question or I'm going to, you know, talk to this person. You know, do you got one of those?
Yeah, so I haven't had too many holy moly experiences from a visit. In a trade show, it's usually just getting a bunch of information from different sources to kind of verify if something's going on with a certain business or with a company. Mm-hmm. But I mean, I'd say the experience generally of investing that I've learned the most from is we had an investment in a solid state drive company, and this company, I mean, solid state drives, there's like a handful of people who make them. And it was more on the valuation side. It was trading at a revenue multiple. The company never generated cash. And I mean, I just realized from that investment, and I lost a lot of money on that investment, that I couldn't project out, you know, what they could do. I couldn't project out adoption rates. You know, it was a new technology. It is a new technology somewhat still. And the pricing, I couldn't decide, you know, as technology improves, the pricing of the product comes down, but then adoption should go up as pricing comes down as well, too. Mm. And so I could never get comfortable with, you know, understanding the valuation there. And, I mean, that turned out to be a bad investment. So
it's usually,
I'd say that was the best important lesson that I learned from my investing career.
I was just going to say, we usually learn the most from our biggest losers, for sure.
Yeah.
So, all right. What then is, on that bright note, hold on. what is your advice for new microcap investors that, you know, based on everything that you said?
For new microcap investors, there's a slight path that I would take. My advice, first word of advice would be read as much as possible. And it's not just read, you know, books about investing, but also, you know, make sure you read the newspaper every day, you know, get follow up on that. But also make sure you read the details of, you know, companies' 10-Ks and Qs and different press releases that they put out. You know, those are really important documents to read. And also, I mean, don't just read things, but Howard Marks has a great book called The Most Important Thing. And, I mean, I that's one of the first books that I would highly recommend reading to a new microcap investor. Mm-hmm. But he always says that, you know, when you read an article or you read something, you know, there's always an inherent bias towards everything that's being written. And so you always need to kind of look past that. And the best way to make money is to kind of understand, you know, what that bias is, and, you know, where are people wrong? And so, I don't know if you've ever been involved in any, like, news article that was written about you or about something that you knew that you were very close to, but when you read, like, a reporter write about it, you know, you read it, and then afterwards you're kind of like, that's kind of what happened in reality, but it's not really what happened. You know, in reality, like, you know, this actually happened. And so when you read, it's important to take that, especially when you read the news, it's important to take that into consideration. And that's one thing that I would give to a new microcap investor is to I would read Howard Marks' book, and I would make sure I read everything I can in terms of the details of a company.
And where can our audience go and find more information about you and Grand Slam Asset Management?
To find information about me, you can, you know, go to Twitter and, you know, follow me on Twitter, SMiri, or you can go to our website, gslamcap.com. That's G as in George, and then the word slamcap.com to find more information. And yeah.
And that's at SNAMIRI, correct?
Yeah. Okay. Yep.
Sam, thank you so much for coming on the podcast. I really do appreciate it.
No problem. Thanks for having me.
Thank you all for tuning into the Planet Microcap podcast, and thank you, Sam, again for coming on to the program. You can access the podcast by going on to stocknewsnow.com under podcast, go to podbean.com and search Planet Microcap podcast, or on iTunes and search Planet Microcap podcast. Stay tuned for the next Planet Microcap podcast, where we'll have our next guest to discuss all things microcap. If you have any questions or comments about the podcast, please send an email to info@stocknewsnow.com. I'd love to hear from all of you. This podcast has been brought to you by SNN Incorporated, publishers of StockNewsNow.com, the official microcap news source, and the Microcap Review magazine. I'm your host, Robert Kraft, and thank you again for joining me on the Planet Microcap podcast. Have a great week, everyone.